You want to? Did you get something to eat?
No, big breakfast. I anticipate missing lunch on these days. I'm either running to the airport or something.
Well, what time is your flight that you need to get out?
3:30. But there's like one every 90 minutes. So.
Well, just one every 9 minutes.
Buchanan is now starting to fly.
Who is?
Over here at Buchanan, they're now doing a small, it's called Jet Suite.
I saw that in the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah, and so it's about the same price you would pay if you were on Southwest paying the paying the business fare, you know, the last minute fare,
you
know, in the $200 range.
Okay. If you can fly on
either
of 2 days per week, it'll work out.
It's a little limited, but it's starting up.
You also have to have a pilot's license.
Yeah, they started a week ago Tuesday.
But have you flown on it yet?
No, I have not. I'm sorry, I have not, no.
Nice looking jets.
Fly in the other day.
That's pretty cool.
I missed the inaugural.
I remember when they had, what was it, PSA that flew out of Buchanan?
Yep.
That was great.
Yeah, and ideally this will expand. You know, you've got TSA issues and other things, and of course the neighbors who, when they bought a house next to the airport, never assumed an airplane would actually be landing. But that's another story. But nevertheless, it would be nice to see more charter aircrafts coming through.
They're doing well.
They always forget that the airport was there first.
Minor details, like when you move next to a farm or a ranch, you hate those cows lowing and mooing and all the rest.
And other things, yeah.
Hey, Candace, you'll be happy to know. I tried to book a flight, was it yesterday or no, the day before, and it was a little tough to find availability on the days
really?
I wanted. So that's a good thing.
Oh, absolutely.
No, that was my view. I was a little annoyed, and then I thought, this is good.
Yeah, no, it's a good thing.
Sorry.
For us, we have to fly out of Burbank, I think. Look like they fly into Burbank.
Yeah, they go in and out. Yeah.
Minor, it depends
Burbank
where you
and Vegas
end up.
At the moment. Yes.
Where you left your car.
Who does?
At the Concord Airport.
On the other side
you
of Burbank.
You probably want to stay away from this connection.
You can get to the Maui either.
Yes.
Yeah.
I want to get out of that connection.
Particularly on the way back.
Yep.
I'm waiting until all your bellies are full and you're asleep so I can go into the governance discussion. So
we can keep going.
Start with the conclusion and the recommendation and then work back.
Can we have him start while we're here?
Yeah, let's start.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because, Debbie, you have nothing else to do.
Nothing.
So it's a short deck. Page 3 outlines our session objectives for this one. So just thinking back to last time we discussed this was the February meeting. And so I think the challenge that we had coming out of that was that we were talking about some pretty nebulous concepts and pretty high level. And I think there's just a general desire to put a scope around it a little tighter, make it a little more concrete, give us something more that we can debate about and figure out some actual decisions to do. So page 3, these session objectives, we talk about rebalancing. This is really two parts. One is the rebalancing back to the asset allocation. The other is a more tactical rebalancing. Do we have particular views on the market or something that we purposefully want to be underweight, overweight? Managing managers is also two parts, hiring and firing. And as a result of that, we kind of removed two other pieces, which were manager structure. And I think implicit in hiring and firing decisions, manager structure is part of that, so that was easy to remove. And the other part we took out was opportunistic investing. We can get there later on, but for now.
Sorry.
Damn party.
Got it turned off. Turn it off.
And so the goal is that we can reach some general consensus that will allow us to start putting pen to paper in terms of specific policy language that we can provide to you in the future. Page 4, just a quick checklist. I think we can skip over that. Page 5, I think, is interesting, though. So this was the whole dot exercise of where do we want to end up. And directionally, we were going from more board-dominant model to more team-based, not all the way to staff-dominant model. And why do we want to do that? I think there are a number of important considerations here, and it really boils down to the efficiency of our decision-making. And the efficiency of our decision-making is really important because we collectively have limited time together, limited time outside of here. And we know that we have competitive agendas. We have a lot going on. So that's part of it. We also know that they are challenging markets. As was pointed out earlier, bonds aren't yielding 6% anymore, so we can't just get easy exposure. We have to be more sophisticated. Thus, we're talking about things like hedge funds and risk parity and private equity and private credit and all these kinds of things. So that's challenging. We have ambitious goals, trying to get 7% return, trying to grow the assets over time, trying to improve our funded ratio. We have some ambitious goals here. And the increasing sophistication and complexity of the markets themselves. So you take all of that, and I think what we really have is an evolving organization, that we started off smaller, simpler, and as we've continued to grow and develop, we're getting bigger and more complex. And so that tends to require a broader delegation of duties, so that not everybody can be involved in every decision, but we have to rely on the experts to do their expert, fulfill their expert duties and provide checks and balances in place, and also provide forward guidance for how we want to steer the ship going forward. So I think that's all resulting in the decision to head towards more of a team-based model. And so page 6 just outlines some of the investment policy development principles. We were talking about starting with a blank sheet of paper. Let's keep it simple. Recognize that the IPS is a roadmap. Intended to be a living document. It will live beyond all of our tenure, board, staff, and probably not. We'll probably have us forever, so that'll be good. But board and staff, anyhow. And then, obviously, a delegation of duties, checks and balances. Page 7 is the current table of contents to our investment policy statement. On the left-hand side, these are the major categories that we outline. On the right-hand side, a potential structure. And the highlight here is really the governance, really focusing on the roles and responsibilities and the authority and the accountability. So let's get into some of these changes then. So page 8, benefits of delegation. Authority and responsibility reside with fully dedicated expert resources, which we discussed. More time to spend on the critical policy and process issues that a board is really charged with making. Create a higher level of decision-maker accountability. And accountability is something we don't discuss much here today because it really depends on who's doing what as to how we set up the accountability metrics and processes. Providing staff flexibility within clear, defined constraints gives staff ability to capture opportunities, while board remaining well-informed with relevant detailed reporting. And relevant and detailed reporting is the backward-looking piece to it, so that you can trust and verify, make sure that what's being said is being done is being done. But I think there's also the component that board provides guidance in terms of what should be done going forward and setting that agenda for staff and consultants.
So on your page 9, Ed,
yes.
Just skipping ahead, you have the current policy on rebalancing on the left side, left column, and then on the right you've got the potential adjustment. Is the potential adjustment including that there's delegation to the CIO?
That's right.
And staff?
Yeah.
So, okay, it wasn't explicit. Obviously that's the discussion. But
I see what you're saying. The right and left-hand sides are kind of similar.
Okay.
So a couple key points on the right-hand side would be, under this first one, maintain policy targets. Rebalancing may occur at any time. So currently, the policy statement says it can happen at any time, that it's scheduled to happen twice a year, but may happen at other times as well. So that is already allowed. This makes it more explicit and actually removes the twice a year calendar rebalancing, which kind of makes sense. Why would you just rebalance twice a year? We're more attentive to it than that. This isn't something that we're hands off on. We have full-time staff looking at the portfolio daily, and you have an investment advisor who's looking at it as well, so you have built-in redundancy there. So it also highlights board notification after policy rebalancing. So this is to say that the rebalancing can occur back to policy targets. Again, these are the targets that you set, right? So it's nothing objectionable from that perspective. Rebalance to it when they get out of line, and then staff can provide the update to say, yep, we rebalanced last month, and here's what we did.
On the affecting tactical tilts piece of the potential adjustment, Are you looking today to establish, to seek establishment of the board ranges, or is it the concept that we're looking at?
We can talk about ranges. More detail is better, because as we put pen to paper on this, that will be helpful. But for now, we're mainly talking about the concept.
Okay.
And if you sign off on the concept,
that makes sense to me. And then if that were the direction of the board, then you'd come back with a more detailed policy statement that had suggested ranges or options for ranges that...
That's right.
We would then select.
That's right.
Okay. All right.
So let's just pause on this one. This was the first key issue broken out into these two components. So does this make sense to everyone? Is this the direction that we're trying to get with the team-based?
Do we want to need a motion? I mean, do you want to take these individually, or do you want to take them as a group? In terms of the content?
Individually.
Okay. Okay. Well, let me take a stab at page 9 then. I'm going to move the recommended change to current policy to include the potential adjustments reflected on the right column of page 9. That the delegation would be to the chief investment officer and staff for these adjustments, with a detailed statement of policy and suggested ranges to be brought back to the board. Oh, that was a long motion.
Second. Was that basically maintain policy targets?
Well, it was actually both. To maintain policy targets, and then the four subcategories of data, but also to affect tactical tilts, together with, in other words, so policy-wise, we're making a change to allow staff to affect tactical tilts, but in order to fully implement this, staff and Veris will come back with recommendations on board established ranges and notifications and so on.
I guess I'm just looking at the lead paragraph for the lead-in.
You have to choose.
Yeah,
to
maintain
it in the
or...
Right.
Does that, Tim, does that give you what you need?
I think they're trying to parse apart that rebalancing can be a rote exercise or a repositioning exercise.
It can be either or.
Now, keep in mind, I think everything we're trying to get to today is give direction to Veris on where you'd like to get to. We recognize there's backfill steps here. If you want to get there, you've got to establish the ranges, and we've got to have all those conversations and that sort of thing to get to the final policy statement. It's where do you want to get to so we can have the conversation about what resources and what steps do we need to engage in. On staff side, where do we need board education from Paris? So the heading there, maintain policy targets or affect tactical tilts, I think it's, those are both subcategories of rebalancing, and Paris is part of those in the two categories here.
I read it as and or. I know it says or, but I read it as and or. Is it and or? Okay. All right. That makes more sense.
Can I ask, just as a practical matter, not to get down to too much of the nitty-gritty of day-to-day, but it does suggest under maintain policy targets that the board notification after the policy is rebalanced. Okay. And that makes sense. But then it goes on to suggest that there's an opportunity for negative consent later on. So does that mean that, you know, once we're told, conceivably this board could say, no, you can't, or no, you couldn't? I mean, I'm just trying to figure out.
Probably more like, no, you should probably change it.
I thought that
yeah,
was.
Yeah, so I'm just trying to figure out how that would impact.
Okay, Ed, you wanted to talk about what negative consent model is, and we could talk about how it applies potentially to rebalancing?
Yeah, yeah.
Unless I hear from you otherwise, it's okay.
let me take a step back.
All right.
Recognition, so at the top it says recognition that rebalancing may occur, one, to maintain policy targets or affect tactical tilts. Those, that is an or, it's not an and. The reason why it's not an and is policy targets are what we set in the policy. Tactical tilts are things away from policy. So it can't be an and, because if your tactical tilt is your policy, then it's just maintaining policy. The tactical tilt is saying we think equities are undervalued and we want to be overweight, and therefore, while our allocation is to have a 10%, I'm making that up, 10% allocation, we actually want to have a 15%. That would be a tilt away from policy target.
Right, but and maybe and or is, was the wrong phrase. What I'm reading is that the investment officer can do both, even if inconsistent.
Yes.
Right. So to me, in my brain, that's and or. Right? But I get that if you look at this in a very refined way, it isn't. So I'm still recommending and would move that the policy be to establish the suggested form of rebalancing so that it's undertaken by the chief investment officer and staff in line with the right-hand column on page 9. And then I think the question, that was the motion, and then the question pending is, can you explain
negative consent.
What the negative consent process is and because when it might occur?
That sounds to me like an opt-out provision, which I think is always a little bit of an interesting way to approach things. Unless we hear from you otherwise, we'll assume it's okay.
And I think the way that would happen, and we can talk about this, so this is one approach, would be to say, going to do this tactical tilt unless the board votes no.
We've been doing it before is the semi-annual rebalancing. Tim does it, then notifies us that it's been done.
Right.
With regards to tactical going outside of possibly going outside the limits, I think what's envisioned is he would come and present what he's thinking of doing, and then we would either accept or reject
right.
that.
Well, it's like a veto power.
Exactly.
I want to talk about the limits for a minute. I'm sorry, Jerry.
Thank you. That's where I was going.
Yeah, because the board already establishes limits and bounds and ranges. We rebalance within those.
Right.
To me, that's safe zone, right? That is standard blocking and tackling. And to me, that is very much what I do today. We go back to target. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't always go back to target, but we're generally coalescing back around those targets. The tactical tilts, I think they could be read, and this is where we need some feedback from the board, they could be read as, do you want to more actively use that pre-established range, that you're not automatically going back to the midpoint, that you're more actively using that pre-established range, or is it that pre-established range is the safe zone, and then one step outside of that is a conversation with the board?
Okay.
Depending on how wide the range is, I guess.
That.
I mean, if it's a very narrow range, if it's a very wide range, then probably not need to come back to the board. If it's a narrow range, it may require you to come back to the board to make any sort of.
If you say plus or minus 2%,
effective
it's pretty
change.
Constrained.
Right.
If you say plus or minus 20%, we'd probably need to have a conversation. So.
Yeah. Okay, so that's the first bullet point under effect tactical tilts is the authority limited by board established ranges. So establishing those ranges and who has control under what ranges would be one decision point. The negative consent, though, was the key issue. And maybe as I'm thinking about it, negative consent isn't even the right wording for it, because if we're talking about affecting a tactical tilt that requires board approval because of the ranges established, then it wouldn't necessarily be negative consent. It would be consent, because you would vote for it either yes or no. It's not like if you don't vote, oh, we're going to do it anyhow. It's that we need a vote, and if you vote no, it's not going to happen.
Yeah, so just say opportunity for board determination, whatever that turns out to be, yes, no, maybe, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So it struck me that the idea was you want a direction. I'm implicit, if not explicit, in the motion was that we would give direction for this rebalancing policy, subject to bringing back the definitive policy language, ranges, and explicit options for those ranges and so on. In other words, this is to get us started down this road, subject to coming back with a definitive policy document and options that we would then formally adopt. That's actually what the motion is.
So I just want to clarify in the motion, and I heard you say it twice, delegate to our chief investment officer and staff, if it's the direction that we're delegating to come back with this policy change, I'm fine with that, but I want to make sure that our delegation of authority in this policy is to our chief investment officer. In other words, we wouldn't want to delegate the authority to rebalance to all staff members. So we would, personally, I would want to make sure that our chief investment officer is at the head of the rebalancing.
I agreed, and I'll amend my motion to make that explicit.
Can I just clarify one thing? Currently, I know we have a target allocation, but currently do we have an established range for each asset class?
Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe just a visual aid here. This could be another
great step. This doesn't differ from where we are.
I promise not to talk about tomatoes this time or anything of that nature. No, it's still up there.
Oh, it's still up there.
That's
funny.
Right now, we would have a target of, let's say, if we had 50% as a target, and we might say, you know, plus or minus 50%. This is safe zone. Anything inside here, we're within policy bounds. Every 6 months, I take a look at this, and we've prepped up to 54, we go back to 50. So we could talk about more active use of this range. What some other system we have adopted would be, there's a safe zone that is fully staff delegated. There is an area here that in extraordinary conditions come back and talk to us. You don't have authority to do this, but you have authority to talk to us about it. It's kind of predefined it. We're okay using this range when there's a really big outsized event, and then some people go to even a third option there, but I don't know if that's necessary. But we can kind of have a gradation of, here's a safe zone, here's an area where we're open to having a conversation, but you're not pre-qualified to use it.
And the next one out is update your resume.
Lost a job.
Kim, what about the
special board meeting?
What about the situation if we're outside the range, we're in the outside zones there, not by any change in policy or allocation, but as due to the markets. What do you see happening in those situations? Would you then do a rebalancing to come back within range or target?
It just via market move. So if one asset class moves dramatically relative to all other asset classes or asset segments, all else being equal, I would just automatically, and we'll take a look at these at least on a monthly basis, we would make effective a change to just come back in here. If we saw an extraordinary event, we might come back to the board and say, we're really seeing something differentiated going on here. We'd like to have a short-term deviation from the long-term policies. Can we have a conversation about this? But the thing is, like, we really have not seen an environment where one asset class has run dramatically at the expense of all others on a 1 week, 2 week, 3 week, even 3 month basis. So we're going to see it coming well in advance. It's going to show up in those monthly reviews. Yeah, something is trending in this direction or in this direction, probably more in this direction, unfortunately. Yeah. It tends to leg down faster than it builds up. And, you know, do we want to take a position contrary to, you know, long-term positioning here? Not contrary, but outside those normal bounds.
Ultimately, everything outside is board.
Yes.
Right. This is the internal board. And how many tiers there are can be structured like staff, can operate within a range, CIO within a range. And so then you even have the bifurcation between what Tim is looking at versus what the rest of staff. You would consider that if you had a larger, more developed staff, and they might have more freedom within their mandates to do things like that. But ultimately, when you get outside, it's going to be board owns it. And so then the question is, by board delegating more internally, can you improve the efficiency of the portfolio by allowing your plan to be more nimble?
Ed, your experience, how wide are the ranges?
Everyone's different. It's personality. The board has a personality.
So, I mean, the wider the ranges,
it's also
we make the ranges, the more delegation we give up, obviously, is the situation.
So a good way of thinking about it is, how heavy of an allocation do you have to that particular asset class, and what's the volatility expectation of that asset class? And those two are going to help guide it, because then you're going to be thinking, what's this really mean to our total plan? How much are we delegating away? But you need to take a look at those two things in combination to create that.
You know, I have a bias towards expanding the responsibility, but on this particular issue, I'm having difficulty trying to figure out the difference between our current policy and what's being proposed. It sounds like it's basically what we already have.
I think it's a more the first bullet point there, the maintain policy targets, it's a more explicit instruction of what we have done in practice. So okay. Getting the language better aligned with what we do actually do in practice. The second one is, do we want to allow a more explicit use of the ranges?
Okay.
Either one range or a range for staff and a range for board.
All right. Okay, thanks. So long as you think we're getting out of our comfort zone, because I want to get out of the comfort zone.
I would say this is a better clarification for me about what the expectations are, and less a deviation from past practice.
Okay. Thank you.
So just to make sure that I understand perfectly, you do have the authority right now tilt between 45 to 55 in your case.
In that example?
Yeah. Now, you don't have the authority if it goes beyond 55 or 45. But if you do want to, you will have to come back and ask for board permission for beyond 55 and 45. Is that correct?
That would in that example, yes.
Yeah. And this proposal will reflect what we just discussed.
If that is the board's desire.
Okay.
Yeah. And so it'd be, and then at what point do you not even want to have a conversation? Where are the full stops? Where is the safe zone? And where is the conversation zone?
So basically, you don't have the authority unless you get board's prior approval, go beyond 55 and the 45 in this case.
Yeah, I want to be clear. I'm highlighting a potential model there.
Yeah.
It's not the one the board has to accept. It's a potential model that's out there. You could simply say, that sounds like a lot more work. We're just going to give you a range and use it.
One thing I just wanted to highlight so that everyone's aware, when we talk about maintaining policy targets, the only change is really about getting away from that fixed, every 6 months this is happening. So going forward, if we were to change that, there might be more frequent or even more infrequent rebalancing occurring around the policy targets. If there was additional authority on the tactical tilts part, I would expect that to be a more infrequent discussion with the board. It would have to be something just really, and Ed can maybe talk a little bit more about what type of tactical tilts we're talking about or what type of market events might occur where we're looking at some of those things. But they're more of the anomaly type events, I would think, that would come back to the board.
So yes and no. Part of our quarterly investment landscape, we usually talk about where would we be positioned relative to policy. So we do this on our conference call, and our research group is saying, every institution out there has their policy target. We would probably be leaning a little more on the risk-averse side right now, just as an example. I'm not making that recommendation, but just that kind of example, that we would probably be a little less we would balance back to target if you're overweight on equities, things like that. Or we would go a little underweight on equities, a little overweight on fixed. So we do make those recommendations, and then that's for discussion in terms of what we're trying to achieve here today with this plan and whether it makes sense for us. So then that leads to our discussion. But you'll hear that come out in our quarterly investment landscape calls and our research reports. And that's just quarter by quarter, and it's kind of that next 3 to 12 month outlook, what we're seeing in the marketplace. And that's how we interpret it. Now, how staff and what research you use and could be completely different. So you might have a different approach.
And what Ed was highlighting, I would probably use as an input into how to use the safe zone range, to Gail's point, the board conversation. Something really significant has to be happening that are deviations from our long-term expectations. And I would think about it almost in the same terms as I think about the current flexibility we have to bring back opportunistic investments. When something very, very significant happens, let's define a conversational range. About opportunistic, we said up to 5% of the fund we can use for opportunistic allocations. When there's a really anomalous event that we don't expect to be a permanent condition, when something is really cheap and we have a high expectation recovery, there's up to 5% of the fund is available to pursue these. I would envision this kind of the same process. When something truly anomalous happens, there's a little bit broader range we're open to having a conversation on. And there's some things we're just not open to having a conversation on at all.
Is it there for what we do today?
With the cash overlay policy, we wouldn't necessarily be taking, buying and selling securities or taking money away from particular managers. We could adjust, with it, at least within the equities, just by adjusting our futures exposure.
It does raise the flexibility of being able to use the cash overlay for that purpose.
So it's not going to be, the transaction cost is going to be much lower as by using the cash overlay adjustments.
If we use the cash overlay, yes. I mean, cash overlay is intended to build in some additional flexibility at lower cost. It doesn't negate the need for physical rebalancing all the time. It just means you have to do it less often.
Yeah.
Can you describe in this section what it is in a motion type form that you would like the board to consider?
I would say probably pick up Scott's motion and say you can direct Varis to come back with proposed ranges for board consideration.
Yeah, my motion currently includes ranges that...
Is that in each asset class?
Recommendations of ranges.
Or each asset class.
Here you have Scott's motion written. You want it?
all three of them.
Does everyone know what Scott's motion was with ranges?
Does Scott remember what he's
got? Well, would Scott like to restate his motion?
While Scott's rereading all of his motions, I think it'll help with each one of the other items. I mean, I think what we're kind of being asked to do here, which is fine with me, is to approve a skeleton, if you will. And we're in that skeletal form, we're approving the skeleton and directing staff and Varis to come back with what the body parts look like, if you'll pardon the metaphor. I think I've pushed this a little too far. You know, to flesh it out. Flesh it out, right?
Yeah.
Okay, that's better.
Stick with medical terms here.
Yes.
All right, you want to...
substitute the U for the E. Right?
Something like that.
Well, the motion is...
My motion is to provide direction to staff and Varis to develop the policy change recommendations identified on page 9 of the Varis report on the right-hand column for both maintenance of policy targets or affecting tactical tilts, with the understanding that in bringing it back, we're giving direction for Varis to develop proposed board-established ranges to be determined along with a definitive final policy document. That's the motion.
I would say we're all grateful that Mr. Gorton never worked on the Ten Commandments.
Moses would never have been able to carry them all down the hill.
That would have been a...
Need a small truck.
Go to Styrofoam.
Does the second concur?
Yes.
All right. All in favor?
Eliminating the negative consent item from the very last line of that column. That was the discussion.
Yes, pursuant to the discussion, I think when the matter comes back, we will see that this will be an opportunity for board approval or some variation thereof. Yes.
For allocations outside the established ranges. Yeah.
Okay. With that, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Abstain? Motion carries unanimously. That's not a motion, I guess it's a...
Did you call for the exasperated people?
No. Can hardly wait to look forward to reading the minutes.
All right, sense of direction has been confirmed.
That was the easy item.
That was a tough one.
Sounds like I'm done.
You have beginner brought in.
Hey, Tim.
Ed, if you'll speed this up, please.
Yeah, right. Let's, page 10 has the current language on manager hires. Anybody can raise an investment idea. Upon approval, there's a standard search process. And there is also a carve-out for a non-standard process, which may be followed. Page 11 highlights potential updates. So hiring new managers, staff given authority to hire new managers up to a predefined limit, parentheses, example, 100 million. You could probably even put parentheses around up to a predefined limit, because it's a question as to whether you want to even create a predefined limit or how you want to think about this. Maybe there's another approach we should be thinking about. Detailed report to the board prior to execution. So again, negative consent or perhaps just consent is a better way of rewarding that one as well.
Approval.
Board members may participate in on-site due diligence, of course, and assignments over 100 million will follow the standard search process, which we put that in quotes to mean what we're referring to on page 10, which is what we currently have. And then specific to follow-on funds, recognition that due diligence requirements are not as high because these are funds we've already invested in. Staff given authority to make the additional investments to maintain originally intended exposure, and detailed report to the board prior to document execution provides opportunity for approval.
So again, if I could just go through the mechanics on this. This means that if we go ahead and endorse this idea too, the board is out of the beauty contest business. The CIO comes in and says, we have selected a proposed fund hire for this particular strategy, and here's all my rationale for doing it. And then the board's only function is to either approve or decline, but they do have the option of saying, as part of the due diligence process, the board members could go on the site visits.
Yes. And I think the way it's written here, it probably said under $100 million is a straw man.
Yeah.
Under a predefined limit.
Right.
It's an implementation exercise. It's probably a staff-driven exercise over the predefined limit. I think the implication is it's an RFP-driven process and probably going through the consultant. But still, whether it's a staff-driven process or a consultant-driven process, there's a final recommendation, a fully baked idea for the board to opine upon, either via positive consent or negative consent.
Would the board have the option, say they chose to depart from this process in a selected thing? You know, normally we'd be happy with that, but there's sufficient interest on the board's part to hear presentation from your proposed candidate or something along those lines?
We're crafting policy in real time.
I mean, I'm just saying this is a significant departure from what we've done. I'm not saying it's a bad departure, but it's a significant departure. So,
if that's the board's wishes.
Well, I'm not trying to plant ideas. I'm just wondering.
I have a question. If we drafted this policy, so say we find a private equity that we think is a good investment, it doesn't go to the board if it's under $100 million. We'd have to come and talk to you and present it to you, and then you'd make the evaluation as to whether or not you wanted to do it if it was under $100 million, and then you could do it and then come back and say, this is what I did, and board would say yay or nay. So the question I have is how will board members who may find a equity firm or some other firm that is a startup, but there's a real strong feeling that might be a way to go for this board, how would they get the board to hear it and know about it?
I think as written here, it says there is a board, there is a staff research process, and we will be perfectly transparent with the board, but these are the managers we're reviewing for these roles as defined by the board. The board has set X percent in private equity, and we're engaged there, X percent in whatever else, and we're engaged in a research process there. So we will be publishing our activities to the board on a monthly basis. You would see who is in our pipeline, at what point, if a trustee had a particular investment idea they wanted to get introduced to that pipeline,
So, but in essence, we would come to you. We wouldn't come to the board and say, this is a fund that I think we ought to get invested in. We'd come to you, and you would have the say, and the board wouldn't have the say as to whether or not it got presented.
Don't we currently vet it a little? I mean, I'm assuming, and because we haven't had that many since I've been on the board, that someone might come to you and say, hey, what do you think? and you just don't automatically say, oh, okay, let's bring them in. You do some vetting ahead
of
time.
Absolutely. They enter into the standard process.
Right.
That's correct. It becomes a new entry point into the standard process.
Okay.
I've never seen one that didn't go through staff.
Right.
And I wouldn't want to see one.
And I wouldn't either. This is classically the CalPERS experience of some years back where you had friends of the board come to their friend, and the investment turned out to be strictly on a board basis, and frequently turned out to have all kinds of
benefit the board member
criminal activities involved.
Yeah, I don't know how other people on the board do it, but I have always a certain amount of comfort in when I get business cards tossed at me at the meetings. Number one, I turn my badge backwards so they don't know who I am. And then later on, I say, you go talk to Tim, you know, because I'm not going to be the one that goes back and says, this is who I, to my fellow board members, this is who I think we should look to or look at. That's why Tim is in the position he's in, and that's why Veris is in the position they're in.
Well, in reality, that's what I have done in the past, but I'm wondering if there might be a investment that a board member might feel strongly about, and Tim may not, and so it doesn't really get presented to the board to consider. That's all.
And you've got trustee comments at the end of each meeting. Yeah. If somebody feels that strongly, would certainly be able to.
Right, which then would require a response from Tim of why he didn't think it was worth bringing it to the board.
That would be
so
okay.
Remote. I can't imagine.
I mean, I would expect his process to be included if the board member had.
So maybe just if I highlight for you the workflow we already have today. The board doesn't have visibility into this. This happens behind the scenes. But basically, we have a seven-step process. And you know, step one is it's just of interest. Anybody initiates it. Step two, it's we're seeing something there. We've got a role. And we kind of tie it out. And you've all seen the funnels. And lo and behold, it works like a funnel. But we have a tie-out for any time we stop due diligence on a fund. We have a rationale for that. More than happy to communicate that to the trustees.
Okay, just a thought I had.
Harvey?
So it sounds like whatever goes into the investment policy statement will include the same process that we're following now for things that staff will make a determination. In other words, that diligence, that deliberative process will be enshrined in the policy statement.
Yes. And I think importantly, we don't implement anything decided, we're not even deciding today, we're setting a model today, we're deciding on policy in the future. We don't implement that until the board is comfortable with workflow, compliance, and reporting. So we've got more steps to go, but we want to know where the destination is so we can build those steps for you.
To a great extent, it's the process that we have already set up, but we're eliminating the bathing suit competition, right? So, which every once in a while that has been useful for me, but I'm willing to give up on that because, you know, I have been influenced in some cases by personal presentations, negatively or positively. So we will not have that now, but I'm willing to give that up.
Just to comment on investing in follow-up funds, the first bullet point there, recognition that due diligence requirements are not as high as for original investment. I think that kind of misstates the situation because we do, as far as contract negotiations, on-site interviews, we actually know these people better than we would a new fund. So I don't want to really see any language in there that the due diligence requirements are lower for.
We have already completed some of the existing due diligence requirements. I think it's probably a better way of phrasing it.
Okay. Probably, yeah. We'll just keep.
I mean, it's kind of an ongoing due diligence, and that we deal with them on a daily or weekly or monthly basis.
If we continue to have a positive opinion of them based upon our original underwriting, our experience with them, our continued interviews, we've already pre-qualified them into the process. We still go through. You've seen the how we re-underwrite existing managers. We put them back to the original ringer, so. We've got a little bit of the work already done.
Right.
Would somebody like to craft a direction of the board to...
One more question. How many funds do we currently have that were invested under $100 million?
I it would primarily be in the private real estate and private equity realm, and it would be most of them, most of the smaller funds, Singular Gov, real estate. I mean, I could go through a list
just,
for you.
Just a ballpark figure. 10 out of how many? 50?
Yeah, 15. Because you would have
15 out of how many? What's our total?
About 50.
15 out of 50.
Singular mandates are above 100 million. Would probably be easier to count under. There's only a handful.
Tim, maybe you can talk for a minute about going forward, you know, because Ed threw out the $100 million is kind of a talking point, I think. Mm-hmm. But maybe you can mention going forward with our new asset allocation, what kind of percent or something like that we could expect actually coming back to the board because they are over $100 million.
Sure. I think the public equity mandates will be coming back to the board. Those would probably be larger mandates. I think the liquidity mandate, obviously, is coming back to the board. That's $1.8 billion. That's huge. And that's the cornerstone of FFP. So that will be coming back to the board. I think this is more the implementation of a broad program that the board has pre-approved. And I'm thinking specifically private equity and private credit might go above that number. But on the private equity, they tend to be smaller individual allocations. And those, to build a diversified pool, you know, it's... We're probably looking prospectively going forward, depending on the model we choose, but if you choose a fund of one model or a directly implemented model, you're probably talking 10 private equity funds per year. It's a big demand on the board's time, and from our standpoint, it's an implementation exercise. I'd be hard-pressed to say it's the highest and best use of the board's time there, but certainly on the big ticket items. And the $100 million should be used as a mental shortcut of, is this an implementation of policy we've already set and clearly communicated? Or is this a potential game changer for Sisera? I think that would be the threshold. You as a board attach a dollar figure to it, but that would be how I'd frame it for you.
For me, when I look at this, so about 30% of the fund managers you would have free rein on, but that's not the dollar amount. The dollar amount is much smaller. It might only be 5% of the total fund or 20% of the total. I understand that perspective. I'm just trying to say that. That does not bother me when I look at it in that perspective. And I think, yeah, you need to have that rein. And the only thing is I'll go back to earlier. If one of us hears something, as long as we have the ability to come in and talk to you and say, this is what I heard, and turn it over to you, because like Jerry over there, I get tired of people saying, oh, hey, guess what, you know, and here's my card, and I hear your system is looking for this investment, and we have that in our, I don't want to deal with that. And I have come to you on a couple of occasions and said, here, this person, please help and take care of it.
Are a great roadblock for all of that.
Oh, you know that too.
Absolutely. So, absolutely. Turn them over to us. Give them my card or contact information.
Okay. Yeah, just carry.
I said that when you first came on board. I think it was one of the reasons I said, we need you.
But that being said, don't want to do anything to craft policy that would preclude any idea from being considered. Right. We are open to ideas from wherever they come from. We're not claiming master of the universe on any of this stuff.
You can tell them you've given their card to Mr. Varys.
Yeah, Mr. Varys.
Mr.
Varys himself.
Well, I went ahead for that one and you'd run all over the place. Do you know Mr. Varys?
Scott, you should either add or detract the masters of the universe from your motion. That language.
This is rough. It's getting to be a sketch right now.
The follow-up funds, we also do, we oftentimes do on-site visits. You might want to add board members participate in on-site due diligence.
It's probably a foregone conclusion that you've already reached, but I just want to put it out there that if there is any change from the current way that we're doing things, authority or discretion-wise, that there will be additional compliance activities on the operational side that are put in place compared to how things are now. So I just thought I'd mention that.
Karen.
I had a question about the follow-on funds. Also, under bullet point number 2, it says staff given authority to make additional investments necessary to maintain originally intended exposure, is that also subject to the $100 million limit, or is that open-ended?
So, great question. A couple thoughts here. One is, we could certainly word it to be. Second thought is, the $100 million or any number like that can be problematic. And I think you have a good rapport and trust with Tim. God forbid anything happened to Tim. But if someone else comes into the role and you end up with a lot of $99 million mandates, you have an odd-looking portfolio with some pretty high transaction costs. But consistent with policy, that's what we've given them. So we might want to think about that. Maybe that dollar amount is specific to asset classes or something, or percent of plan or something. We can think more about it. To, you know, to Jerry's point earlier, this is the skeleton. This is kind of what we want to be thinking about doing, how we actually word it. I think we should probably put more thought into how that works. And then, to Karen, to your point, it probably ties in there as well.
So do you want more direction on whether they would like a limit on this or whether it's open-ended?
This one in particular for follow-ons?
I take the language to mean, or not that we're hung up in the language, to maintain the originally intended exposure. If the exposure was up to whatever it was, then they wouldn't have authority to go beyond that exposure.
Right.
I mean, that's what I'm seeing.
It's sort of a self-limiting thing.
That's the way I see it, but I don't know if that's right.
The follow-on fund could be $200 million.
That's not the way I see it, but I'm assuming it wouldn't exceed the original authority. But that perhaps that needs to be clarified.
This isn't a follow-on fund. Isn't it?
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, you're right. Okay, right.
With the same manager, right?
Right,
so,
yes.
So it's Warburg Pincus 13.
Another $100 million.
The question is simply, will there be a limit on it or not?
Yeah.
Because under the bullet points don't say that there will be a limit. So that may be
I guess I'd be more comfortable with some consideration of a limit on the follow-on.
Yeah.
So
I mean, for the most part, I can't remember a follow-on fund up to this point where we've been more than 50 to 75 million
additional. Yeah.
So if we did, that's not to say tomorrow. but the other one is necessary to maintain originally intended exposure to the asset class, exposure to that manager. We just need to define it a little bit more.
Strike that language and just put the dollar limit.
A dollar limit. Yeah. And appropriate. I mean, and whatever you feel is after looking at it, having a chance to look at it and see what. And it's all. This is all going to come back to us for fine tuning and approval. So.
Did you get that, Scott?
Yeah, this is getting pretty interesting.
Page two.
Right. Are you ready for your motion?
I'm trying.
Resolution proposed.
Hang on, I'm sorry, Tim.
Sorry, John. Could I just clarify one thing?
Sure.
I think implicit in this is things come to the board much more fully baked.
Yes.
Much more what?
Fully baked.
Okay.
Legal negotiations have been launched, maybe not concluded, but launched. On-sites have been conducted. And so, Brian, to your point on the on-sites, again, implicit in error, but part of our activity report to the board is these managers in the pipeline, and, oh, look, these three, we're conducting on-sites on these dates. Mm-hmm. If a board member wishes to join for educational purposes, they're welcome to become observers in that on-site process.
That would be fine.
Yeah, but which brings me to another question. So we go to Sackers, but we don't know that you're looking at an under $100 million fund to be invested in, and the people come up and talk to us, and we're not supposed to. So we don't know that you're doing that. You
still
need
has to trigger a quiet period, and you have to know it.
So there will be the communication out. Yeah. We'll have to agree upon what point in the process the quiet period is triggered.
That's
part of that communication to the board.
Okay.
Like I said, we need to define the destination. There's a lot of backfilling.
Mr. Gordon, do you have a proposed resolution?
Yeah.
Four score.
Yeah.
Now what?
Kick this one down the road. I'm going to move that we provide direction to the CIO and Veris to develop policy for manager hires that is both for manager selection in the implementation of established asset allocations as well as for investment in follow-on funds. And for each of those two categories that the CIO would be given authority to hire new managers up to a predefined limit to be established in a recommendation from staff and Verus back to the board, currently exampled at 100 million, that the hiring of new managers would provide for detailed reporting to the board prior to execution of investment manager agreements, such that the board could not approve. Board members should be allowed and may participate in on-site due diligence visits. And any hiring of new managers above a predetermined limit, for example, 100 million, would follow the standard search process. For follow-on funds, in addition to what is in writing, that staff would be given authority, the CIO would be given authority to make additional new investments for follow-on funds with a predetermined dollar limit. And in all respects, that this policy would be brought back to the board so that we can have a definitive policy and establish ranges and predetermined limits. That's the motion.
Okay. Second. I'm glad that Mr. Gordon also didn't work for the IRS.
He did.
Oh, no.
I didn't read that.
All right. The resolution has been, proposed direction has been submitted and seconded.
I missed the part after I make a motion.
Make a substitute. As guidance to Ed and Tim. All in favor?
Clarification.
Which part?
Clarification. Wow, where to begin? I just want to make sure that when our CIO makes the choice to invest under $100 million, he comes to us and says, this is what we're doing, and this is why we're doing it, and that we get to hear that.
It does hear that.
Because what I'm worried about is the ongoing funds part of it. So if we have a fund manager that we're already into, say, $150 million, and they've got a new program that they're offering that's $50 million, and he says, okay, this is really good, and he decides to do it on his own, then that's now $200 million. And 6 months later, they come back and say, oh, we've got another one that's really good, and he says, that's really good, another $50 million. So now we're up to $250 or $300 million. I want to know that when he does that, when you do that, when the CIO does that, you'll come to us and tell us, so we can also know what the total amount of money is that's involved with that fund. Now, if that's included in your motion, I'm in favor of your motion.
Yeah, it's included in the motion. It's bullet point 3 in the investing and follow-on funds, which is
a detailed report
to the board prior to document execution, providing for our ability to veto, and it's right. Point 2 in the first.
Thank you. Just wanted to make sure that was there.
Okay. Any further? With that, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Abstain.
Abstain.
Abstain. So we had, we don't have Will, so 7 approvals, 1 abstention. Okay.
Did you get the abstention?
Okay. So,
manager termination.
Manager termination.
He can handle all of it.
Pages 12 and 13. 12 has the current policy, so board decides if manager should be under review. Staff to notify the manager, basically the watch list protocol that we've been following. Quarterly reevaluation of managers, and then emergency situations. Staff notifies chair and vice chair. Staff notifies custodian to stop trading and emergency board meeting called. So the proposed or potential updates would be, under normal circumstances, staff has the authority to terminate a manager. A detailed report to the board prior to termination provides opportunity for, again, approval rather than negative consent.
So again, I think I would request that under normal circumstances, it is the CIO that has the authority to terminate a manager, not use the word staff. And again, with the hopes that this process would have to funnel through our CIO as the terminating person.
Also, a question on something that sounds like a sort of a due process step has disappeared. It doesn't sound as if there's any further use of a review authority being implemented. That on your own volition, the CIO has the authority to terminate someone without that firm ever having been put on review. Has the review step disappeared?
The review step hasn't disappeared. I think it's become an operational step. And so what we can envision is kind of building a matrix here of all of our managers and our rationale for holding them.
Yeah.
And then we would, similar to the heat maps we've seen from Ferris on the red, yellow, green, are they meeting expectations? Are we into the yellow zone? Are we into the red zone? That's a communication that we would have, again, on a regular basis mm-hmm. back to the trustees. So would the manager be notified? We can talk about whether that's a useful exercise.
I'd feel more comfortable, I think, having managers know that they are on review and that there is a process that the organization has for making that determination, as inexact as ours has been in some cases, that there are criteria for being put on review, there are criteria for being taken off review, and if that's an authority we delegate to the CIO, that's okay, but it looks as if the entire process disappears.
Well, I'd say if there's a communication to the board, it's a public document. So managers definitely have access to that. We have ongoing communication with all of our investment managers. I think they know where they stand and where we have concerns. We're sharing that in a very open dialogue with them. If you want a formal letter, a formal notification, we can talk about that. I think we've got a lot of tools in place that get us there. What would get us there?
I just think there might be something that is served, something served by the fact that in a public manner, a firm has been placed on review. And in the way in which it's being envisioned here, I don't think that ever gets to the board level that firm has ever been placed on review.
I struggle with the role of being placed on review of what it does for the organization or for the manager. A courtesy heads up.
Yeah.
Could certainly accomplish that in a number of ways, but...
To me, it suggests that this board has taken... whether or not we're still the entity that does that, has taken the step of acknowledging that a tripwire has been hit. Either we've got a staff problem or we've got a performance problem. This board is aware of it. The CIO may well have the authority to go ahead and place them on review, but there is a tripwire, and you guys tripped it.
And I would say the reporting out to the board of kind of the color-coded matrix of where we have concerns, that is the report on, you know, where has somebody crossed the tripwire. Oh, there's a yellow flag here. This is in the gray area. There's a red flag here. This is really kind of problematic.
Yeah.
Tim, maybe just clarification to me. Under current policy, we deal with managers under review. Then we go to potential update, and that goes directly to termination as contrasted to the review process. It looks to me like the review process would stay the same. Am I misreading that?
And I think you're right. I think this is a manager termination approach. Manager review, monitoring, ongoing disposition of a manager isn't being considered here.
Yeah, okay. All right.
And I would just encourage the board to reconsider the watch list policy as part of our monitoring policy. Everybody is always on watch. There's something about the language of a watch list that says, oh, we started watching you.
Yeah.
And it's a misnomer there. And so I want to embed that in the mentality of how we're monitoring everybody all the time.
You could imagine a number of outcomes in the review process, too. If a manager is underperforming or personnel departure, PIMCO is probably a great example. Key person leaves. You change the guidelines, rein in what they're able to do, negotiate lower fees, don't go through a termination process. So they would never hit this. So they went through this review and they took actions and they agreed to it and everything stays as it is today. So that could be an outcome of that process. But this page is really thinking about when you get to the termination stage, what do you do?
Question. In the potential update, just hypothetical. Tim, you're on vacation. You're long gone. Suddenly, one of the funds finds itself in serious trouble, and the stocks are dropping like wildfire. So your staff calls the chair and the CEO.
It's in July and it's a Todd.
Yeah.
There you go.
Call, okay. But you're not here. I want us to be able to say, he can phone in and say, hey, yeah, my staff is doing what I would do if I was there, and we can go ahead with it without him being here. So I think that needs to be in there so that that's covered. I want to hear from you. I want to know that, yeah, that's what you want to have planned, and that's what you want us to do. But I think it needs to be stated that if you're not here physically, that a phone in or email or something that says that is then acceptable.
Unfortunately, in this day and age, I'm almost never out of reach.
All righty then.
You give it some more thought. I have one more. I'm giving you another minute or so.
That's true.
Not to nitpick the thing, but where does the CEO fit into this process? We've now set up an organization that sounds almost as if, in this case, it's a she, is not in the loop.
So, I would say all of my activity. So I'm talking about this activity report to the board. I already provide an activity report to Gail on a weekly basis. So the same kind of communication channels.
Yeah.
And we can embed that in the policy.
I just want to make sure that that's not left out, so it looks like, I mean, at some point, I hate to say this, but I report to the board, I don't report to you. You know, there is still a hierarchy in this organization that I assume is going to be maintained at some point.
Yeah, I think we're talking about job function, but we definitely want to make sure that the reporting function is represented as well.
Okay.
Thank you for pointing that out. Yeah.
For what? You hadn't noticed?
No. It's true.
Yeah.
Would you like to propose a board resolution?
Sure. I'm going to move that we provide.
Some of us are double parked, I might add. So
direction to Varis and the CIO for a policy update on manager termination, which is the policy update reflected on page 13 of the Varis report. With the following addition to normal circumstances, a new bullet one, CIO to determine if manager under review and notify board, and thereafter CIO has authority to terminate a manager, and then bullet three is a detailed report to the board prior to termination, providing for opportunity for board approval or disapproval. Under emergency situations, to clarification, the chair would be notified immediately by the CIO by all available means. And then bullets two and three, it's the CIO given authority to terminate, and the CIO presents a long-term remediation plan. With those adjustments, it's the recommendation on page 13. That's the motion.
Second.
Okay. Don't you want to add in also that he notified the CEO?
Yes, I'm sorry. I didn't. I was listening and not writing. So, yes, and notification to the CEO.
Second.
Thank you.
On both situations.
So chair and CEO notified immediately?
Yes.
Okay, good.
That's my motion.
Okay, any further discussion? All in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Abstain. Okay, abstain. So 7-1. All right.
Good news, Scott. I don't think we need a resolution for next steps.
Yeah.
Let me take a shot at that one.